So Bubba and John were recent graduates from a university in Georgia. They both excelled in their classes. They knew their stuff. And they were competing against each other and against 30 other applicants for a very prestigious, important, high-paying job. Well, the head of the company said, John, Bubba, we've narrowed it down. It's one of you two that's going to get the job. So we're going to give you another test, a very difficult test, and that will determine who gets the job. So they took the test, and the CEO said, you both did very well. You only missed one question. Each of you only missed one question of the entire test. I'm very impressed. I'm going to give, and Bubba's thinking, he's going to give it to me because I'm in Georgia. I'm a Southern boy. I have the edge. Since everything else is equal, he's going to give it to me. He says, I'm going to give the job to John. I'm Bubba Shaw. How come? I'm from Georgia. And the CEO said, well, Bubba, you both only missed one question. Number 9. And John wrote on his paper, I don't know the answer. And you wrote on your paper, neither do I. So, you may wonder where this is going. But the point is that it wasn't intelligence that got John the job. It was integrity. Yeah. Honesty. Bubba didn't have that. Clearly, he was looking at John's paper some of the time, and he didn't get the job. And, you know, it's rather interesting. Well, this brings us to the Bible and social science. In the 1990s, I found this really not only fascinating, but important. In the 1990s, psychologists, psychiatrists, and other social scientists discovered that there's something more important to a person's success than intelligence, something more important than IQ. It's called social intelligence. Some social scientists call it emotional intelligence. There's books out on it, lots of them. Emotional or social intelligence. And they discovered that far more than intelligence, emotional or social intelligence is what is the leading cause of success in your life in every realm. It's the greatest factor in every realm of your life. In your marriage, in raising children, at church, at work, conflict resolution, with neighbors. I'm not, doesn't have to be, the two can be divided, but conflict resolution, or your neighbors, any aspect of your life, the most important factor in determining your success is your social intelligence, how you deal with others, how you communicate, you treat them with honor. And what's really awesome, they discovered that in the 1990s, what's really spectacular and it should be exciting to us is the Bible has been teaching that for 3,500 years. They may not have called it emotional intelligence or social intelligence, but that's exactly what the Bible has been teaching. For example, this is written 3,000 years ago in the book of Proverbs 15, verse 1. It says, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. I started getting that some years ago. As you have, isn't that true? If you start off with a harsh reply, you're going to make a person bristle. You start off gently, and it keeps the spirit open. I will say that a few times each year, actually, if I ever get the chance. Luke 6:31, treat others the same way you want to be treated. Well, that makes sense. Mike, I don't even have to talk to you about it. I know that when someone treats you unfairly, they put you down, they dishonor you for whatever reason or in whatever way, you feel that. We all do, because that's human. I don't deserve this. So God says, for a long time now, treat other people the way you want to be treated, and guess what? Your success rate in every realm of your life will improve. And there's lots more, but I'll only give you one more for now. If your enemy is hungry,
feed him.
If your enemy is thirsty,
give him.
And sometimes, and I gave you an example on a Wednesday night, sometimes they don't stay your enemy. The Bible says when you do that, you pour coals on their head. It doesn't mean physically harm them, but it means, whoa, I've been wrong about this guy. He's kind to me, even though I've been a jerk to him. And so the point is this, that the Bible has been teaching what you need to have a successful life on earth from the first words that it wrote. It teaches this emotional or social intelligence. So I'm going to ask you a rhetorical question, but find this first. Do you want to bless your children? Of course you do. Do you want to give them what they need for the most successful possible life they can have? Of course, we all do. Or grandchildren, if you're my age. Now, I'm pushing the down button. There we go. Then I'm going to suggest this, because Christianity is a volunteer lifestyle. Teach them the principles in Romans chapter 12, the one that Larry and Roger and I are working to share with you some of it. It's a huge chapter, 25 commands in one little chapter, more than any other chapter in the Bible. But if you will teach these to your children, you will bless them immeasurably with skills and understanding that they will not have otherwise. I mean, I'm not saying you can't get the same principles in other parts of the Bible, but wouldn't it be awesome to maybe sit down with your children or your spouse once a week, or if that's too much, once a month? Say, hey, today let's talk about Romans 12:1. Therefore, I urge you by the mercies of God to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, etc., etc. What do you think that means, Jeremiah? Does that mean anything to you? Well, here's what I get out of it. And then you go down to let love be without hypocrisy, or love your enemies, is it going to get to later. Don't return a curse for curse, but a blessing instead. You teach them these principles, and they will have a head start on life that few children, even in the church, have. It's powerful and life-changing. And if you will review that once a year, the next time you go over it, their paradigm will already have shifted, and you'll even get more out of it the second time you go over Romans 12. But I don't know if there's many ways you could bless your children more, assuming you love them, than if you teach them the principles in Romans chapter 12. So we're going to begin. We'll just read the five verses that I have. Even in these little five verses, there are 13 commands. Beginning in verse 9, let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor that which is evil and cling to that which is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love, preferring one another in honor, not lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, devoted to prayer. Rejoice in hope, persevering in tribulation, devoted to prayer. I think I said that earlier. It was serving the Lord in verse contribute to the needs of the saints, and practicing hospitality. Each one is a full sermon. So we're going to look heavily at verse 9, because all the others that follow and that precede this verse in Romans 12, they all are leading to the same point. Let your love be without hypocrisy. And I love what Roger had to say, because I'd concluded it the Saturday before he preached. So I was just lying in bed mulling over this chapter. Roger said that Romans 12 is a commentary on the entire New Testament. I think that's a pretty accurate description of the chapter, man. It gives you all the essence of the New Testament in one chapter. I'm going to suggest to you that all of Romans 12 is dependent upon one verse, verse 9. Let love be without hypocrisy. And I will tell you this, that I struggled with this for almost a week. I'm mulling it over. How do I preach on that? Let love be without hypocrisy. Now, you know what hypocrisy is, and so do I. When I think of hypocrisy, I think of the people that Jesus is talking about. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites! And then he says, you swallow a camel, but you strain it a gnat. You're a whitewashed tomb, pretty on the outside, but full of dead man bones on the inside. You devour widows' houses. They would, listen, Marcy, you know, don't trouble yourself with paying the rent and the mortgage. Give me your papers. Sign your home over to me because you're old. Now I'll take care of you. And they would devour their houses. Oh, I'm sorry. You didn't meet the contract. You're out of your home. These men, if there were women, then women too, but these Pharisees and scribes, they didn't have love. Jesus says so. Matthew 15, verse 8, he also says, in vain did they worship me, but he says, these men honor me with their lips. Oh, God is good, but the heart is far from me. That's what God said in the Old Testament and here in Matthew 15 around verse 8. Their heart, they didn't have love. And I said to myself, that does not fit Romans 12. Romans 12 isn't saying, you dirty hypocrites. He's not saying, be a Christian, not a hypocrite. That's not the message there. You read the context. I said, how do I preach this? Let love be without hypocrisy. And I don't like to use commentaries very often, but they have the value. I like to use them last, because if I use them first, they put me on their track and my mind isn't free to think more openly. It focused my attention. But I said, man, I need to see what these guys are saying. Guess what they said? Yeah, hypocrites are two-faced, like the Greek actors. You know, the Greek actors, they wear a smiley face to show it a certain emotion, but you couldn't see the face underneath the mask, and they weren't that person. Or they play a king, but they were a poor man. Or they play a bad guy, but they're a good guy. Or they play a good guy, but really they're an evil actor underneath. But hypocrite meant actor, and not really being who you're pretending to be. And I said, that does not fit the book of Romans. There may be some churches that had more hypocrites in it. That doesn't not fit this message. So I read. So then one commentary in passing, he said, you know, if you want to know about love, read 1 Corinthians 13. That's all it said. Read 1 Corinthians. I said, yeah. Let me think. Love is patient. I know that I have love in my heart for God and you. And the lost. I know I do. I know that you do, because I see it in your actions, even though I can't read your hearts. I see it. So let me ask you this. Since we're people of love here, I like to pick on Mike because he's so close and I can see him without my glasses. So Mike, I know that you're a devoted Christian. You've proven that with your life. I know you have love in your heart. Are you ever impatient? No, hypocrite! The point is this. Well, don't raise your hand, but how many of you are ever in any given year unkind? Well, I'll raise my hand. I'm unkind sometimes. But 1 Corinthians 13 says love is kind, not unkind. So I said, I get it. I get it. And then if you, so you're here because you want to be, unless you're under 18 or whatever. You're here because you want to be. So loving God with all your heart, mind, and soul that Tara read about, that changes the person's life. So you can raise your hand if you want to, but it might be embarrassing. So if you love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and strength, as it says in Luke, how many of us never, ever sin? 1 John 1:8, here's what it says. Remember, Romans 12 is writing to Christians, good Christians, loving Christians. So is 1 John. He calls the people, John calls the people he's writing to, beloved. And he calls them my little children, endearing term. But listen to what he says in chapter 1, 1 John, verse 8. If we say we have no sin, we are deceiving ourselves, and the truth is not in us. I get it. I get it. When it says, let love be without hypocrisy, it's telling us what to strive for. Because every one of us shows inconsistency in the way we love. Even the best of Christians in this room, we are inconsistent and we blow it sometimes. So it's saying, here's what to work for. Work on loving without any pollution in your love, without any contamination in your love. Get that stuff out. And then it's going to tell us how to do just that thing. And the next, read the whole chapter, but the next verses that we'll cover. But I want to camp here because I believe this is the core, the foundation of all of Romans 12 and one of the most critical verses in the entire New Testament. Love without hypocrisy. Well, what does that mean? Well, the next verse, let me just see what has coming up next. The next verse says, abhor what is evil. Do you know what? You can't be, it means to be disgusted with evil. It means to hate it. And if you don't hate evil, you don't have love. Because love, true agape love, acting in the best interest of other people, demands we hate evil. And if we hated it enough, none of us would ever sin. Ever. If we hated it enough, like God does. I hate evil, but I don't hate it enough. It's a constant battle. That's why I still blow it, and I need to work on my love so it doesn't have hypocrisy in it. Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, evil is very enticing, as we all know. We've all participated in it. How can you get yourself to hate it? What does that take? I'm going to suggest that you look at the damage love has done to people you love. Look at the damage evil... did I say that wrong? Look at the damage evil has done to the people you love. Look at the damage. Cost lives and paralysis and messed up relationships and messed up bodies and... on and on and on we could go. Look at how sin has messed, has hurt us as individuals. None of us have lived without it, and everyone has suffered the consequences of sinful mistakes we've made. Hate it. And if you don't, think about the damage it does to wonderful people. Then it says, cling to what is good. By the way, that word cling, it's the same word God uses when he says a man, a husband, is joined to his wife, cleaves to, exactly the same word. grab onto it. And God says about marriage, what God has put together, let nobody separate. That's what he's saying about good. It's a training, growing, learning process. But learn what is good and then grab onto it with all of your strength, because Satan is going to shake you as hard as he can to get you to stop loving that which is good. But love demands both of those. True love means I hate evil because it's harmful, and I love good. And by the way, you know the meaning of the word love. There's more than one word in the New Testament, but this is the word agape, which means it's sacrificial. This kind of love means that others, I act to help them out. Others are more important than me. It's a sacrificial action. It's not an emotion. I'm not saying love is without emotion, especially other kinds like phileo, but agape love is not built and does not depend upon emotion. It is built upon sacrifice and concern. And when it says God so loved the world that he gave his only, that's the agape love. He sacrificed it all. So these are the core of the New Testament. Love without hypocrisy. Don't have tainted love. Don't have blemished love. Have genuine love, sincere, pure love. It will change our lives. I mean, we are working on that now, and it's changed our lives, right? But we have a ways to go. Plenty of scriptures on that. I think we'll move on. So we're talking about loving without hypocrisy. So true love is genuine. I think we'll refer to it throughout this lesson as genuine love. You can call it pure love, sincere love. We're going to call it genuine love, and it's represented by a heart of pure gold. Love with hypocrisy, it isn't that you were the scum of the earth, because you are not. You are children of God, but we still sin. So love with hypocrisy just means our love is incomplete. It has holes in it. It's cracked. And throughout life, I can guarantee you, the guy was just teasing a minute ago, I can guarantee you that Mike has filled in some of the holes that used to be in his love. His heart of love is healthier than it used to be, as with most of us, if not all of us in this room. What we're discussing today is the difference between incomplete love and perfect love. Complete love. Genuine love. That's our message beginning for today. Let your love be complete, not incomplete. Let it be genuine, not with holes in it. So here's how I wanted memory verses that will stick with me anyway. Hypocrisy is all about me. All about me. Why did the Pharisees devour widows' houses? Because they were greedy, selfish, and mean. It was about them. I want her house. Love is all about others. Pretty simple. Nothing new, but I need reminders sometimes. All about others is complete and perfect. I like to think about it like this. Love with hypocrisy is selfishness. Love without hypocrisy is selflessness. They're almost spelled the same way. The main difference is the letter I. And that's what it boils down to. Hypocrisy says, I'm the most important, and my actions prove it. I know he needs help, but I just don't feel like it. He's kind of weird. That Mike Brenneman, you know, I don't want to deal with him or whatever. But the word I and the letter I, that's the difference. Hypocritical love, I don't like to say it that way. Incomplete love, love with hypocrisy, incomplete. Hate what is evil, cling to what is good. We just talked about those two things. That's one of the ways we exhibit our love. Hating what's evil. And so I'm mulling this over. What would you, if you were preaching a sermon and you had to preach on hate what is evil, what would you say? Because There's so many ways to illustrate that, but I'm thinking, since I've been reading about Netflix lately, I've been thinking about Netflix. Netflix has just produced a movie that's portraying Jesus as an active homosexual, an active one. And one of Mary's is a prostitute, and Jesus having an affair with her. I mean, it is so blasphemous. It is so derogatory to the God that loves us. And it's intentional. And right now there are 1,400,000 signatures protesting it. And if you have the gumption, all you have to do is punch a couple of buttons, write in your email address. But I would love to give you the link so you can write Netflix and say, not on my watch. So my question is this. Let's say that you protest and they still, the movie's done, but they put the movie out for human consumption. And you're a subscriber of Netflix. What will you do? In my opinion, hating evil means you're not going to get my money because you are blaspheming my God. I'm done, Netflix. If they don't, if they repent and don't produce it, great. But I think that's one example of how to abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. So let's look at these concepts. Now let's look at the rest of the chapter, comparing incomplete love or love with hypocrisy with genuine love right here. So in the next verse, as we read about clinging to what is good, it says, be devoted to one another. That's verse 10. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Well, you get it, but the deal is this. If you look, most of you know the Bible is written in another language. It's written in ancient Greek. And sometimes it's really tough to translate a verse exactly right, to get all the juice out of it, to get the best out of it. But this be devoted means to love tenderly. And it really is redundant because it says love tenderly one another with a brotherly love, like they're your real brother or sister. Now, maybe some of you have problems with brothers and sisters. That's okay, but I'm assuming you still love them. And this is saying, love Christians like they're your family, which means you spend time together. It means there's action involved. Love each other with the tender love, a family love. And then it says, giving preference to one another in the next verse. And this one, I think I misunderstood it. I'm sorry. So if you're devoted to others, to loving them, if you're involved, then that's genuine love. If you're kind of on the periphery, you're not engaging with Christians, God's family, your family, if you're uninvolved, then that leans towards love with some hypocrisy in it, because you claim to be children of God and families stick together. The next one, in the same verse, is prefer one another in honor. And I thought this meant prefer one another in honor meant prefer being with Christians over non-Christians. That's what I thought it meant. Prefer one another. But that's not. If you read the context and maybe study some of the words, giving preference to one another in honor means, Daniel, you're more important than I am. I see you looking at this last piece of pie and I want it too. Yours. Or you need a ride? Well, man, I wanted to watch the Seahawks play, but hey, jump in, man. I'd rather give you a ride any day than watch the Seahawks. Giving its preference to one another and it honors them. That's the idea there. You get the idea. Genuine love versus incomplete love. Put others first or neglecting them. Not lacking in diligence, fervent in spirit, devoted to the Lord. This not lacking diligence. Diligence, as you probably know, means to be a hard worker. In what? Well, number one, in preferring one another, being devoted to one another, but way more than that. It means to presenting our bodies to God as a living and holy sacrifice. I mean, being transformed by the renewing of our mind. It just says, get in there, roll up your sleeves, and dig in. And some people, look, it's just a fact of life. We've probably all struggled with this at times. Some, after being converted, maybe never learned. Maybe they weren't taught. Maybe the person that brought them to Jesus wasn't that diligent themselves. I don't know. There's a lot of reasons why people lag behind in diligence. Sometimes it just, they've been hurt by people they love, whether they're Christians or not. And they just, it just isn't worth it. Or they've had health problems, which is a very real thing, as we know. Or the church has done them wrong in their mind. Or they get caught up in just getting through life, which is very challenging. And that's why everybody needs Romans 12. It'll help us get through life. But they put their focus on making a living and just putting out fires. And for whatever reason, they're not digging into spiritual things. They're lagging behind in diligence. Instead, the opposite of that is being fervent in spirit. That means excited, on fire. How do you do that? Again, I don't know who's on fire here, but with this many people, bound to be some of us that are in a low spot in our life. How do you change from that, from not being on fire, from just going through the motions and getting through the day and forgetting about God? How do you get to being on fire, excited? Well, we go back to verse 2. It says, don't be conformed to this world, because there's a lot of pressure to become like everybody else in the world. Don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed. That's the idea of metamorphosis, if you were here about a month ago. The idea of radical change. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. How do you do that? How do you do that? There are a lot of ways. You can spend time with good people who lift your spirits, who set an example. But I'm going to say that the number one most important way to renew your mind, and this command is given to elders, as well as brand new Christians, the best way to renew your mind is learn how to read the Bible and understand it so you can see its power and its beauty. Suck it in. Drink it up. Because that's what chapter 12 is built upon. The previous 11 chapters tell about the mercies of God, the goodness that He's on our side. So read your Bible so you can see the beauty and the power of God and of Christian life. One of many things you can do. It says rejoicing in hope. Man, that is what keeps us going. Rejoicing in hope, because life is tough. Life is tough. And without hope, who's going to try? You know, we don't get to go to heaven. There's no such thing as heaven. And I mean, you don't say that, but my point is this. If you have no hope, why be diligent? But God, who keeps His promises always, gives us instant after instant. I came to give you life and give and life abundantly, abundant life. And I have a reward waiting for you. And you want the best relationships? Then stop lagging behind in diligence. Get on fire with the Spirit and dig in with your Christian family and do something, because your joy level, it will go up. But hope is huge, because it's in contrast to the next one, persevering in tribulation. Look, they go hand in hand. For some reason, I think we know why, but God designed life to have problems. Heaven's where we're not going to have to worry about mowing the lawn or putting up with a loud neighbor or someone who throws their garbage in our yard. That's heaven. That's the hope. But right now, as you know, life full of trials and challenges and pain. And it's the hope that keeps us going through it. We persevere because there's something better, and we believe it. And our actions show that we believe it. Amen. So we're patient in our troubles. Person that isn't, they're going to give up. They're more likely to give up. Devoted to prayer, it's connected to rejoicing in hope and persevering in tribulation. Sometimes that brings us right back to where we should be. God, I am struggling mightily. I have not talked to you the way as often as I want or in the right way. I want to change. I want to rejoice and hope like Arcella Anderson. I want to rejoice and hope like Greg Pasqual. These two Christians that many of you have not met in different congregations, their tribulations, the pain in their life makes my life look at Disneyland every day. And they are two of the most joyful people I have ever met in my life. Lisa would say, let's go visit Arcella again. She lifts our spirits as hard as her life was without giving you the details. Hard. She gave us hope because she rejoiced in it. We could see it. And then she got married late in life and her husband, Brother Anderson, I just forgot his first name, but the same way, man. Greg Pasqua. Wow. If you don't know him, you're missing out, but there's not time to meet everybody. Just joy all the time. Let me be like that, God. Help me, because he always answers prayers. God always answers prayers. You will not be disappointed. So we're looking for God's guidance, but love that is with hypocrisy, love that is incomplete. Here's what happens, at least in my life. Problem. I go, oh no, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Lord, Lord. What should I do? Give me strength. Help me remember the joy that I should have, the hope that I do have. Not what am I going to do, but how do I get through this, Lord, with your guidance? That's the idea of this devotion to prayer. And you know, it's like eating to me. It's like eating to me. I love eating. I love eating. And I have three regular meals every day. I don't miss my meals, right? But believe me, I eat spontaneously a lot. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I'm working. I run to the kitchen and grab a handful of something and I eat it. And I love it. And eating sustains me. Without it, I die. Same with prayer. I want it to be spontaneous. I want to be in the habit of thinking, hey, here I am. If I have to set my alarm, at least on the vibrate. Oh, when I get a minute, I'm going to thank God. Or I'm going to cry out to God. Sometimes it's just help. But I am going to devote myself to prayer. And that is one of the things that changes our lives. Then, contributing to the saints and practicing hospitality. Well, first, before I get to that, I want to jump back up. Sorry, Bill. Here I am being random. But prefer one another, this be devoted to others in love. Let me just tell you that Rogers mentioned it in two sermons that I've heard. How that when there were many Christians' homes that were greatly damaged in one of the hurricanes, I don't remember which one. Several of you, what, Bill, 6 people out of this congregation flew down 2,000 miles away to help them hang sheetrock? That's devoted to one another. That's impressive to me. It lifts my spirits. So glad to be a member here. Now the last verse, verse 13 that we're going to look at today, it says, contributing to the needs of the saints and practicing hospitality. So contributing to the needs of the saints. Not only did some of you fly down, this is monetary help. Well, it doesn't have to be just monetary, but that's implied here. Contributing to the needs of the saints. It's not from the church treasury. Hey, elders, you know, pull out your checkbook. That sometimes is necessary, but this contributing to the saints is a command to individuals. If you see a need, help out. And I got to tell you, when Lisa had pneumonia not long ago, we were offered money. And we were blessed by that. We didn't take it, but just to know that you're willing to do that, some of you are willing to do it. More than one person offered that. But some of you did make us meals, and others offered, but we had enough food from those that gave us meals. That's contributing to the needs of the saints. So money or other things that help in a physical way. This needs doesn't have to be just physical. It could be I'm lonely, they're lonely, I need help, I need counseling. All that counts. And then it ends with this. It says, practicing hospitality. Now, there's a hospitality room in hotels, and most of us have a feel for that. Maybe you all know what it means. But in the original language, it doesn't mean just have people over for lunch. Xenophilia is the Greek word. It means to love strangers. He says, hey, what is it to love people that love you? He said, the Gentiles do that. Big deal. I mean, it's good to love people that love you. I'm not saying you shouldn't. But true hospitality means you see somebody in this building visiting. We would win a lot of souls just by showing our love, not by feeding them. Food doesn't convert people, but by showing love. Hey, would you like to join us for lunch today? That's hospitality to somebody you don't know. Scary? Of course it is. Of course it is. And notice it didn't say do it once. It says practice. And were you aware that it's one of the requirements to be an elder? I know the elders are aware of that. But it's required to be an elder is to show hospitality. But it's commanded of Christians. And there's a really cool verse in Hebrews chapter 13. Verse 2. Hebrews 13, verse 2. Verse 1 says, let love of the brethren continue. Verse 2 says, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. For by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. Is that cool or what? It's saying that some people who practice hospitality, oh, hey, you need something? And they didn't even realize they were showing love as strangers to an angel. Does that still happen today? We're not told. I don't know. But Abraham did it, saw three people, and he ran to them because he had a heart for hospitality. His nephew did it. Lot. They both entertained people, showed hospitality, and they were angels. Wow. And if that still happens today, maybe God will make sure they have a little quirk to their personality. So you go, shit, do I want to invite this person to my house? Look, I don't know if it still happens or not, but he's saying it's a big deal. It's a big deal. Something that the elders do. And all of us should do. So practice in hospitality. And I know what some of you are thinking. I'm getting to know some of you. You're thinking, well, you know, I think I'll start with like the people that are really safe. You know, the Wards and the Olsons and the Quinns. And if I get good at that, maybe I'll take a sip out a little bit, you know, and invite Harold and Sue or, you know, the Nears or whatever. But no way I'm having the Bredmans over. Do you know how much they consume in one meal? No, it's something he's asking us. If we want our love to be genuine, if we want genuine love, if we want a pure heart, it means practicing hospitality and contributing to the saints. But the hypocritical love says it's about me. The pure, genuine love says, I'm going to share my blessings because God sure has poured them out on me. It's time to close, so just a few more things and we'll be done. The idea here in the whole chapter is that we're to grow in love, present our bodies as a living sacrifice, be transformed with the renewing of our mind, love without hypocrisy. The whole idea here is growing love, perfecting love. And I'm going to tell you, if you don't already know it, you're already thinking it, I'm assuming. If I were in the audience, I would be, whoa! To have genuine love, that requires some heavy lifting. That's going to take major effort. And it does. As I said, in this one chapter, not just my section, but in Romans 12, there are 25 commandments, more than any other chapter in the New Testament, even Matthew 5 and 1 Peter 1, more commandments in this one chapter than any others. But let me say this. These commandments are not given to us to be a heavy load. These commandments are not given to us to burden us. We're given the concept of how to have genuine love to ennoble us, to enrich us with human virtues that will make our life so much better. Romans 12 is meant to bless us and to be good for us. So my prayer for you is, may you grow, and may I grow, may we grow in genuine love. May it increase, and may our imperfections decrease. If you're not a Christian, God says that you were dead. You're dead in your sins. And the Creator, who created you for glory, does not want that. He calls out through His Son Jesus and through His Word, please, come to me. And He's hoping that you will say, after reading Romans 12 and the rest of the Testament, Jesus is worth it. I choose to be a living sacrifice for God. That is His hope. If you're not a Christian yet, but you would like to change that today, then please, as we stand up to sing the song of invitation, just come forward and let us know what your spiritual needs are.